Oh, good morning, everybody. Hello. Welcome to Turning Towards Life. This is Lizzie and Justin on a Sunday morning in amongst the kerfuffle of life, coming to you from our small little home offices for our unrehearsed and deeply meaningful conversations. Deeply meaningful anyway to both of us to be here every Sunday morning at around about 9 o'clock UK time. And we are today bringing, well, Justin has brought this beautiful source from Robert McFarlane and his book Underland, which I'm sure Justin's going to tell us more about Robert and everything in a minute. And I want to say this morning, I've woken up with a deep kind of gratitude, gratitude for all kinds of things, but this I feel extraordinarily energized by and grateful for, and feel like it is a pillar of goodness in my life. And I'm really, really happy to be here and happy to be wandering into this conversation and curious as to what will come, because every time we do this, something new gets born. I don't feel like it's the kind of space where we trot out what we already know, but we venture into new territory, and it opens my mind and my heart and my sense of the world in all kinds of ways. So I'm just very, very grateful to be wandering in, as we normally are, into the conversation.
Got a lovely beginning, Lizzie. Hello, everyone. I'm just enjoying, Lizzie, the sense of being in a kerfuffle this morning. So we are late starting because of me, because I didn't manage to get my life, sort of all the different parts, organized in a way that I had intended. And then I've just noticed, of course, for those of you who are listening later and not with us live on Facebook, you may know that we go live on Facebook when we do this conversation. You can always join us there. And I've seen that I've announced this morning that we are live for Turning Towards Li rather than Turning Towards Life, because I was in such a kerfuffle to get the thing out on Facebook. I didn't even finish the sentence. So I'm sort of enjoying just that. And really struck by what you said, Lizzie, before we take this source and see what comes from it. That sense that what we're doing here is, as we begin our fourth year, so this is the first week of year four together, that sense of that the point of this is really, in a way, venturing into the unknown, is not knowing beforehand what it is that we're going to talk about, or even what a source means. And I've been thinking about this a lot with this source. There would be a way of coming to this conversation sort of having worked out what there is to say between us, or even just individually worked out what there is to say. And I know that that's not what we're doing, that the source, of course, knocks around in our minds and our hearts and our bodies for a while, and stuff comes from it. But we really never know what we're going to get into. And I think that that's one of the, I think getting lost and found again together in the midst of this conversation is really important, and it's a really important part of being human. So I'm really glad to bring this. This was so for those of you who don't know Robert McFarlane's work, he's a British writer, and he's the kind of person who heads off into the landscape and has very beautiful and amazing things to say about what it is to be in places, and is doing the work of connecting up places with the human heart so beautifully. And I've been loving immersing myself in his work over recent months. And this little section comes from a book called Underland, which is all about, it's really about underground places, caves and underground rivers and what's under glaciers and also under the ocean. And this came into Turning Towards Life, Lizzie, just because I noticed how touched I was when I read it. When I read this part, I could feel something shift in me that felt very important. And so I wanted to bring it in and see what would happen. And for any of you who love language and poetry and writing that really gets into the heart of things, I can recommend Robert's writing so wholeheartedly. So here we go. This is what he writes. Maybe this is among the best things we can try to do, I think, to be good ancestors. I remember a paragraph I have copied out into a notebook from a book called After Nature. People are best able to change their ways when they find two things at once in nature, something to fear, a threat they must avoid, and also something to love, a quality which they can do their best to honour. Either impulse can stay the human hand, but the first stops it just short of being burnt or broken. The second keeps the hand poised, extended in greeting or in an offer of peace. This gesture is the beginning of collaboration among people, but beyond us in building our next home.
Maybe this is among the best things we can try to do, I think, to be good ancestors. I remember a paragraph I've copied out into a notebook from a book called After Nature. People are best able to change their ways when they find two things at once in nature, something to fear, a threat they must avoid, and also something to love, a quality, which they can do their best to honour. Either impulse can stay the human hand, but the first stops it just short of being burnt or broken. The second keeps the hand poised, extended in greeting or in an offer of peace. This gesture is the beginning of collaboration among people, but beyond us, in building our next home.
I think one of the reasons that this touched me so deeply is because I could feel how difficult it is to live in a way that might have us be good ancestors. And that at least for me, the thing that's most difficult about it really is fear. And how easily we've talked, you and I, Lizzie, lots about this, but we've also talked about this here in Turning Towards Life. I think like lots of us, fear really has its way with me very easily. And it's very easy for me to pretend that that's not the case. Like I know that that's one of my ways of being in the world is to go, no, I'm fine. But when I'm afraid, if I don't start to get up to what Robert's inviting us here about, finding something to love, and a quality which I can do my best to, I just want to see what he says, to honour, then my life gets really small, like the horizons of time really collapse in and my interest in other people and what's beyond me gets really small. I really get into kind of like self-preservation. And it's really easy for me, I can see, to live a life where what I'm doing is, am I all right? Am I all right? Am I all right? Am I all right? Don't say that to me. Don't do this to me. Hold, cling on to things really tight. I mean, this seems to me this is writing about clinging and grasping and holding on. And it's how much letting go on my part it takes to really let myself love and to love in a way that whatever I'm afraid about, I think it must be not that I stop being afraid of the things that I'm afraid of. Like I don't go, I'll pretend that that's not true. But that when I hold that, and I can also find that of me that is much, much, much bigger than that and much kinder than that, I have these moments when I really can extend myself out beyond my own self-interest and beyond the interest of people around me and start to feel like I might be playing my part in a way, way longer time horizon that started way before me and ends way after me. But I'm really curious in talking about it, about what it takes to do that, because I noticed that that's not the way that comes first for me. The truth is, the way that comes first for me is the other way, is the doing whatever I can to stop myself getting burnt or broken, but not anything more than that, and I'll be okay. So I think that's sort of where my wonderings begin about this.
Yeah. I'm feeling very moved by the... It's so interesting how this is kind of playing out in me, because I can feel... being what it means to be a good ancestor and finding something to love. And I was in a conversation recently about that balance with our children of showing them the news and overexposing them to the, you know, all the stuff that's happening in the world, and feeling into how important it is to have a legacy of love, where if people who come after us are going to make this world a different place, they're going to have to love it in order to do anything that makes this whole system different. So how are we, as good ancestors, creating something that's lovable, that's worth saving in the face of everything that it's become and how hard that is? And so to find a way of finding something to love and letting that be what saves us in a way, that letting that be our saving grace that we love, which is not a survival narrative, but a deepening relationship to what life might be. And then having that be the vortex into which we invite people around us, and that being what a good ancestor is, feels like the conversation. And it's a brave one, because as you say, it's so easy to go, am I going to be all right? What do I need to do to protect myself? How can I make sure everything's okay? In all, you know, whatever ways. And I think what I notice is that when I extend myself beyond that, like looking after somebody who's not really mine to look after, or in the kind of broader definition of cultural individualism that we have, or finding something that's about love that feels unreasonable or bonkers or countercultural to the point that it feels awkward, I notice I get alive. I feel interested in my life. I feel like, ooh, okay, now I have energy. Whereas when it's about me and these four walls, it feels way less interesting, even though I might feel more, I don't know if the word is comfortable, even though I might feel more comfortable and safe, I don't necessarily feel enlivened or drawn or brought to something in a new way. So I think I can make the distinction between the parts of me that feel self-protective and what they generate, which is a life of safety and comfort and me, me, me. And then I can tune into the life that happens where it's risky and I'm extending beyond a narrative that the people who are interested in safety would get cross with me about. But those are the places that I feel alive, and like, I don't know, like that's what life actually is. The unpredictability of it, the riskiness of it, the... the beyondness of it feels like that's where this legacy, this ancestry can actually be one. Because in a way, you have to do something outside of what's gone before in order to be a good ancestor. That kind of has to happen. We have to go beyond something. I think that's what this is saying. And for that to come from finding something to love feels really kind of mystical in a way, but really profound and like a huge and important invitation to me.
I was so touched when you started to talk in this way, Lizzie. Like, you've really opened something, a sort of way, new way of seeing in me. To say back what I think is at the heart of what you said, which is that to be a good ancestor is to dedicate ourselves to loving the world. And I was immediately, what came to mind for me was a line from a Mary Oliver poem, which I can't remember which poem it is, which begins, her first line is, "My work is loving the world." So to see that, to love the world is a commitment that we make. It's not a feeling that we just have. Like, it's not something that it's a different thing to waking up and saying, well, I love the world when I feel like it. Instead, it's a seeing what we can do to live in such a way that evokes and reminds us and deepens our love for the existence that we find ourselves in. And that love as the dominant orientation is what makes it possible for us to be good ancestors and to take care of things. And fear in that context. So it really struck me that it's one way of talking about it is it's something like the wider context, the wider narrative or orientation in which we live. So when fear is the biggest context that I've got, my life does feel very small. I'm reactive. My body goes, oh, you know, or jumps all the time. It's like, oh, I have to stop this, I have to stop that. And it's really easy for life to collapse down to something incredibly self-centered. But when love is the bigger frame, fear can exist right in the middle of it. Like, I can fear, and the actions that I'll take for the sake of love are different to the ones that I would take as if they were for the sake of fear on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And I can see how this is a practice. It's a path that we have to walk. It's not, we live in a culture that treats love. I mean, there's all the problems of individualism and all of that and consumerism and all of the, like, the story that we have that the main point of my life is to make sure that I'm comfortable and that I have what I need and nothing gets in the way of it and nothing should ever threaten it and all of that. But we also, I could feel how radical it is to make the claim that love is not a feeling, but an orientation, a promise, a set of practices, a way of talking, a way of looking, and that we might then feel very deep things as a result of it. And that's sort of, you talked about it being a mystical, that is the sort of the mystical part of it, is it's a commitment. What I could hear in what you were saying was a commitment to keep on coming out the world as if our responsibility is to love, even when we don't feel it, even when it's not the first thing that happens.
Yeah.
And that's going to mean all kinds of ways of practicing in our lives, ways of learning to lurk, ways of feeling. And I think it involves a lot of the arts of life that have got, that are sort of deeply unfashionable, but really, really life-giving.
Mm.
Like poetry and art, like really deeply listening to people.
Mm.
And like something that Robert McFarlane actually says somewhere in a different book, which I really loved, which is, so of course this, the thing that really also struck me whilst you were speaking was what he says here, which is that this is about loving what's beyond us. And I also think it's letting ourselves be loved by what's beyond us. So I don't think it can just come from inside us. And he says somewhere, we most of us have lived in a society where the human will has been made the most important thing. So being able to have will and act on it, I get what I want to happen, is like the primary value. And in that world, we treat everything as something to use. You know, the woods, the forests are wonderful because I get to walk in them because they make me feel good, as opposed to I love them. Like when we love something for its own sake, not because it's going to be useful to me, but simply as a commitment, it's also very much like how we might love. Like, I know this, all the great loves of my life, the friends who I care for deeply, you, my family, people around, the sense that I have is what has these relationships be what they are is the commitment to not love somebody because they give me what I want, but simply to love them for their own sake. It feels like it's a similar move that we largely don't it's not part of our story of what it is to be a human in the world. So it's no wonder that we're afraid and that we're grasping and all of that.
I'm so moved by this kind of what you're saying about having a narrative of love and what that really means, like the distinction of something. You said, you know, love isn't a feeling and might include feelings, but I think that's what our culture's done to love, is it's kind of made it into I love you being the definition of the story of what love is. And as you're talking, I'm feeling really called into this inquiry of, I'm noticing that when I love something, I'll do very different things than when I don't love something. So when I love something, like something I'm doing or a person or, you know, I'm just thinking how much I love poetry, for example. There's a relationship to things that feels so much more like it leads somewhere. Like it doesn't feel finite. So letting love be the way that I make decisions, or the way I treat someone, it feels so much more about the unknown than the known. You know, like I love what this is. I love what our work with people in the world is. And so much of that, I really don't know what that is, but I know I love it. But it doesn't have like a bound on it. It's not completely defined and locked down. And it's like love lets something have a spaciousness that, like you're saying, if it's a person, you can sit back and revel in someone because of everything that they are, even if there's bits that you don't like or that aren't preferential to you. And it feels like because we love, we can allow things to be what they are or what they want to become. Feels what there is to witness, what there is to receive, rather than some kind of small version of life or small version of self or small version of events happening or something. So I feel like to love what we're doing, who we're with, what's in nature, technology, whatever the thing is that feels like the draw of love, it's a deep and grand permission for things to be just the way that they are, and for us to be in receipt of them as humans and participate with them, rather than trying to grab and grasp, as you were saying, and get it into a form that I can, my small self can feel like I've got, or I possess, or it's mine, or there's ownership or something. So when I feel into loving our work, for example, Justin, I feel like because I love it, I can let it emerge. And I haven't got to put it in a box of some kind, but that I can speak about it in a way that new things get born in the speaking, because there's love in it. And it's not some method, and it's not some structured something. Of course, there's those parts about it, but really at the essence of it, because there's love there, there's an aliveness and a wondering and a quality of emergence that really feels enlivening. It feels like I start basking in the reciprocity of life when I love something, because of course I'm bringing myself more fully to it because I love it. And what I receive from bringing myself fully and from what is actually the field of what's there, I can feel it. I can experience it. So it feels like the Mobius strip of receptivity opens up when I love, because I don't have a small narrow channel for it to flow back through, which is a demand. It can come in all ways. I don't even know if this is making sense, but it's like, feels very much what I'm in this moment feeling into my reality of what it means to love.
You're making a ton of sense to me. And you said something that I want to echo, because it's so radical and so important, which is that love, what you were just talking about, seemed to me, is that love and reciprocity are really, really closely linked. So if I track back a moment, I think that the difficulty that we're in is that we have it's so easy to have a consumer narrative about life. This is about me getting what I want. And if I don't get what I want, I'll be afraid and graspy and judge other people. And I mean, really, that's such a trap for me to feel that way. And I think that we can treat love as a similar project. Oh, now I'll love and then I'll get what I want. And you saying something really different to that. So what I think you said was that when we really commit ourselves to love as the ground, one of the things that happens is it can open us to the possibility of having the world meet us. And that way, love isn't, it's not a sneaky means to getting what I want. It's a way of letting myself be open to what's here, what's coming, and to allow myself to keep on feeling the possibility that what is happening is love, regardless of whether I like it or not. And I think it's a really radical change, like being able to be in this conversation and come at it from love, which is a kind of deep faith. And the conversation might go terribly wrong, and we might get terribly lost, and who knows what might happen. The technology might stop working. Or I was thinking about our work, Lizzie, to teach something or to be with a client where it's tricky, bumpy, and instead of demanding that it feels a particular way, to keep on committing to this being love and to receiving whatever's here and responding to it. And to Robert McFarlane's point, to let ourselves be really committed to being loved by the world, rather than just saying it's all down to me. Like, I now have to love, and it undoes our centrality in things to come at things this way. And so it's a kind of deep, it's a really deep commitment. And I think it's something that so many religious and spiritual paths at their best are onto when they're not behaving as secret ways to free us from all trouble and all of that kind of stuff that any of us can get into. And I, what also occurred to me whilst you were speaking, Lizzie, was that this is why practices of gratitude are so important, but not the gratitude practices that will make us feel yummy all the time, that version, but the version of, oh my goodness, what a giant improbable mystery it is that I'm here. Even when I'm afraid and it's difficult and things are under threat, that kind of gratitude is the ground for a proper commitment to love. And I'm so struck by what happens if we can teach ourselves this and teach our children this, to keep coming at the world this way rather than the way that we keep on getting taught, and we're bombarded with messages and images all the time that's the opposite to this, that's starts from a different place and answers a different question than this one.
I'm really sent down this path of wondering about gratitude and what it really means. And it's so easy to think that gratitude is just a kind of like a shallow way of pushing things away. But I feel like whenever I've been in the inquiry about what gratitude really is and been in a, in, and I feel like I am in the practice of it, I find myself being grateful for all kinds of things that I, at the beginning of the process, wouldn't say I was grateful for. You know, it's allowing the gratitude inquiry to deepen and deepen and deepen until we can include everything. And that really is a genuine process to stay with and to wonder about the things I'm not grateful for. And if I place them in the narrative of love and of loving, what do they become? Like, I feel that's a really important thing to really genuinely stay with, is including, like you were talking about that poem, Justin, about swimming being a practice of welcoming what's not welcome. Like, it's really possible, even the really, really, really horrible things. I feel like, of course, there's some edges to it, and haven't managed to welcome the things, some things I haven't managed to welcome, but things change, things shift if they're welcome as than if they're not welcome. The actual something shifts. Its nature changes if it's allowed rather than pushed away. And I feel like that's another attribute of the narrative of love, which is that we are actually really powerful in what we can welcome, what it's possible for us to welcome. And then what we can do when things are welcomed is different to if we've held them at arm's length. And I think that's really what gratitude is to be the kind of beings that love and welcome whatever might be here as best we can, and work with it from a place of love rather than a place of rejection or criticism or whatever else we might experience that comes from a fearful, rejecting separateness.
I'll read for our closing, in response to what you just said, Lizzie, the last line of this source. This gesture, I think the one you're talking about, is the beginning of collaboration among people, but beyond us, in building our next home. Mm. Thank you so much, as always, for being in this conversation. And thank you, everyone, for accompanying us, whether you're just joining us for the first time or you've traveled alongside us for the full 3 years. We're so glad that you're here. And all being well, next week, Lizzie will do this again.
We certainly will. See you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.